This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Storytime, 9 o'clock horses, episode 23. That afternoon, sitting quietly with my mother enjoying a cup of tea, I thought about this man named Jack, who'd led my mother on a merry chase. Or had he? I tried to imagine him in Australia in a gold mine and asking this man, C.J. Boyle, to write a letter. Could it be that Jack could not read or write? It was a puzzle and sad that we would never know. I looked around at all the things I remembered in the living room. It was all so familiar, just as it always had been. Even as a child, I remembered the same pictures on the walls, the black upright piano, the alcove where once the sewing machine had its place. It was comforting to find the sameness in everything, a permanence that one does not find in the States, where everything seems so temporary. Except, I was now used to old buildings being replaced by new ones, furniture changed to keep up with new trends, and homes being sold after only a few years. I had become very used to new things, new places, and the varieties of food available in America. In England, buildings are preserved. Families live in the same home for 30 or 40 years, some all their lives. Routines are kept about meal times and the type of food. It's an old saying in England, at least among the older generation. If it's good enough for me, Dad, it's good enough for me. Things don't seem to change. The furniture in my parents' house had been reupholstered by my father years ago, but it was now looking very shabby. I began to imagine new furniture, plain wallpaper instead of the huge paisley design. The worn Axminster rug with its faded reds and blues would look great with plain wallpaper, and yes, the curtains, they could be a coordinating color. I was visualizing a three-piece suite in neutral beige. I could see it all in my mind's eye, and I was excited. The thought sprang to my mind quickly, and without thinking further, I turned to my mother and said with a smile, "How would you like a new three-piece suite? I could buy you one." She looked at me, and I saw the same look in her eyes I remembered from when I visited her at the Towers Mental Hospital. She said icily, "You keep your Yankee dollars." I was stunned. I had, in one sentence, ruined my relationship with her once again. I had pushed aside any thoughts that perhaps their furniture held special memories. I was the one who should have apologized for my ignorance, but she never afforded me the chance. Once again, the chasm between us opened, never to be closed again. I stayed away from my parents after that period for weeks at a time. I wasn't bored, but I was missing my apartment in Redondo Beach with the open window, the view of the ocean. I liked my flat where I was now. I'd been living there for 6 months, but to look out on a parking lot didn't exactly thrill me. The flats across the way were identical to mine. I was often drawn to the window to see people coming and going to their cars. I learned their routine. The girl directly opposite always wore long skirts. It was a time of the miniskirt, so she stood out as someone very different with dark hair swept up in a ponytail. She always carried a huge handbag. There was a young man who lived next door to her. He walked to his car at about 8:30 in the mornings, and at one time he glanced my way and waved. He was tall, dark-haired, and carried a briefcase. He was always smartly dressed in a suit, a pastel-coloured shirt and a tie. Undoubtedly, he was a handsome man. After Reuben, I was determined not to look up any man at all. I didn't want anything to do with men. I purposely stayed away from the places I'd frequented during my teenage years in England. I did miss the ballroom dancing, and the thought briefly about joining a club entered my mind, but... Well, Britain has always held dance clubs at the local dance hall studios. It is a great place to meet people. I liked that. I found Jenny's school was the place to meet women with children, and I was fortunate that I met two wonderful women who arranged a party for Jenny when she turned 6. We often met for coffee in the village after that, and I began to feel at home in Oadby. One warm, sunny day, I was walking to the village with Jennifer in her stroller when a car pulled up beside me. "Need a lift?" It was the dark-haired man from the flat opposite. "Oh, thanks," I said, "but, you know, we like to walk." After he'd introduced himself as Mark and I told him my name, he asked if I would like to have a drink with him sometime. "You know, one evening," he said. "Well, sounds nice, but I need a babysitter." "Right," he said. "No worries, I know someone." About a week later, he knocked on my door. A young girl who lived close by was eager to babysit. Her name was Rosamond. Mark, I found out, was a sales representative for a large pharmaceutical company. I joined him in the local pub, and I noticed he did like to drink a lot, which was a bit worrisome. But since I never intended this friendship to go further, I didn't fret about it. Jenny seemed to approve of our relationship because she always asked where he was. When he bought her the gift of a hamster in a very fancy cage, it seemed to seal the deal of their friendship, until the animal got trapped in the bars of the ladder and hung itself. She was devastated, so was I. But Mark came to the rescue and bought another hamster in a plain cage. He was 25, I was 31. After I had vowed that I would not get entangled in another relationship, here I was again. What was I to do? Mark had asked me if I wanted to meet his parents, and I'd always been reluctant of that, fearing he might be expecting more of me than I was willing to give. But eventually I gave in, and we visited his mother and father, who owned a bungalow in Leon Sea, a small coastal town on the east coast, where the low tides leave fishing boats high and dry until the tide rescues them again 6 hours later. Mark's father was a minister at a local Baptist church. He was a patient and loving man, and very nice to his wife. I figured that he didn't need to know that I'd been totally turned off any religion, especially in a Baptist church. That was when I was young. Unfortunately, he didn't talk about it. He was obviously delighted. His son seemed to have found someone to be with, and he encouraged us to leave Jenny with them if ever we wanted a holiday alone. I began to appreciate having a father figure for Jennifer and grandparents who adored her. And when Mark suggested a holiday in Tunisia for Christmas, I was happy that he included Jennifer. In the early 70s, new resorts and hotels were springing up in isolated spots along the Mediterranean coast of Tunisia. Tunis lies between Algeria and Tripoli in North Africa. It became a city 869 years before the birth of Christ. There, the sea shines green and blue, the narrow streets round are mosques, minarets, and historical buildings. Date palms line the avenues where camel markets are held, and spices from all over the world are sold. The mixture of Moors and Arabs embodies a colourful past. At our hotel, chickens roamed around the outside of the resort, and grass-roofed palapa structures lined the beach directly outside the back of the hotel. In the foyer was a very large Douglas fir. It was Christmas time, of course. I supposed it was imported to make the tourists from Europe, England, feel at home. Unadorned, the tree looked odd amid the potted palms and exotic plants, and I decided at least it should have snow. I had brought a bag of cotton balls with me, and I asked if he would mind if I spread them along each branch to look like snow. The manager was puzzled. In his broken English, he said he'd never seen snow. He'd no idea what sort of a tree it was either. Then there was the Christmas dinner that was presented in a very strange way. I thought it was amusing. The sliced turkey came as one course, The dressing came as another. Even the potatoes were served separately. But there was a loud-mouthed English lady at the next table. She leaned over to me. "Oh, isn't it awful?" she said in her broad Midlands dialect. "Fancy serving Christmas dinner like this." She shook her head in disgust. I turned to her and smiled. "Well, if you wanted a typically English dinner, you should have stayed at home." Most of the breakfast were scrambled eggs with very orange yolks, served with grainy bread and date jam. Delicious, I thought. Other meals were mostly couscous with lamb and carrots, which is typical North African fare. We went on a camel ride in the desert outside of the resort. Our group was asked to dress as Bedouins for fun. The garb wasn't very flattering, but I didn't want to spoil it. Unfortunately, my camel was in heat, and Jenny's camel was forever trying to mount mine. Finally, a man who we'd met at the hotel, Don, who apparently was used to riding camels, rescued her quickly and hoisted her up with him. My she-camel went berserk, took off with me among the high pear cactus, with the male camel running after us. All I could do was hang on. Riding a camel is not like riding a horse, believe me. One thing I do remember clearly was the day at the spice market. Men in white robes sat cross-legged in a line on rough wooden boards on the ground. Their teeth were yellow, and they spat tobacco into the dirt. Each man had a pair of scales in front of him. I asked one man if he had saffron, which of course is very expensive in the States. It's from the three stigma of the saffron crocus, and it is hardly likely to grow anywhere but special places. He nodded and asked me to put an American quarter on one side of the scale. Then he filled the other side with the scales full. The saffron pile was enormous. Saffron is light as a feather. I told him all I needed was a little bit to take back with me. It was quite a unique experience, wandering through the very narrow cobbled alleyways, checking out the lovely hammered copper jugs, pots, wonderful things unknown in Britain, and the Moroccan rugs hanging outside the very tiny, tiny storefronts were very expensive. A storekeeper, seeing my interest in the hand-tying of the rugs, came out to greet us and immediately asked me if he could touch my hair. Tourists, women with blonde hair, are unique, apparently. This man whispered something to Mark as we left, and I asked him what that was all about. He said the storekeeper had offered 500 camels for me. Mark had told the man to make it 600, and he'd consider it a done deal. I was happy knowing my daughter was being educated in England. I thought the school system at that time anyway was far better than in America. Although, based on my own memories of my early years in school, I'm not sure why I determined that to be true. In the 50s, when I attended the local primary school, it was basic reading, writing, and arithmetic that was emphasized. Nothing like the social studies in the States. Handwriting in those days was taught on a daily basis. Knuckles were rapped if you didn't do well in cursive writing. We had a school nurse and a knit nurse. Hard to imagine the weekly inspection of head lice in those days. We had no gym clothes. We had to strip to our underwear for exercises in the large hall. I'm sure I never thought about the smells of sweaty kids that must have lingered there where so many other things took place. We were given eye tests, hearing tests, and vaccinations for German measles, all at the school. Education in England these days is streamed and divided into stages based upon age. One is for children 5 to 7. Stage 2 is 7 to 11 years old. 3 is 11 to 14. And four age stages is 14 to 16. And that's optional. Private or independent schools are known as public schools, which must be confusing to Americans. Grammar schools were originally attached to cathedrals and monasteries teaching Latin, the language of the church. With the introduction of universities in the late 12th century, a grammar school became the entry to higher learning. Cathedral schools in England were closed when King Henry VIII destroyed all the monasteries. Grammar schools became part of the modern education system and still remain the gateway to a college education at the age of 16. When I graduated with an O-level, that's an ordinary level, at 14, it was not an option for me to gain my A-levels and college because my parents needed me to pay room and board. I had to go to work. The thought that I had never had a college education made me feel inferior when I first came to the US. Even my parents had assumed I would never amount to much because I'd been ill when the 11 plus examination had taken place, and the all-girls secondary modern school did not bode well for my future, or so I was told. But now I was back in UK, and I applied to the city's education department to take my A-levels at the local grammar school. I had permission to attend classes with the 16-year-olds. It was an interesting year of my life, and when I emerged with my A-level certificate in English and History, I felt confident I would eventually attend college, even if I was well over 30. In the meantime, Pauline had been asking me to visit her in Kenya. I was thrilled to be able to travel anywhere, but to Africa, well, that was fabulous. When the school year finally ended, I left Jenny in Mark's capable hands and flew to Nairobi alone. I was amazed at the amount of hours we travelled over the Sahara to get to East Africa. Nairobi in Kenya is a marvellous place. Pauline and Richard's house on Livingston Drive had beautiful mahogany floors polished by the Shamba boys almost every day. I thought of the boys as the silent people. They walked the halls of the house with bare feet. It was a little unnerving to realize that suddenly I was not alone, not unless they were wheeling the tea trolley along the hardwood floors, which did make quite a racket. In my bedroom, my sister warned me not to leave anything close to the windows because of the pole burglars. Like Hawaii, there was no glass in the windows, just bars. It was easy for someone to hook a purse from inside with the long pole with a hook on it. Pauline's five daughters were all beautiful, confident and smart, world travellers. Louise, the oldest girl named after my grandmother, had been born in UK. All the others were born in Africa. I went alone on safari to the famous Treetops Lodge in Nyeri, the Aberdare's National Game Park. This is where Princess Elizabeth had been staying the day she became Queen of England, on February the 5th, 1952. As I read the plaque with the date on the wall of the Treetops Lodge, I remembered that day very well. The broadcast stations were silent, except for a few words, every half hour. This is BBC London. The King is dead. Long live the Queen. Because I was alone on safari, I sat up front with the driver in the zebra wagon. I asked him how much he liked Kenya, now the British had left them to their own. He told me he much preferred his English brother bosses to the Africans. They were much kinder, he said. Kenya gained independence from the British in 1963. Now, 10 years later, the street names have been changed from British Street to Kenyan. Princess Avenue became Kenyatta Avenue, and so on. However, there was still the elegance of an old era of British colonialism in the Norfolk Hotel in Nairobi, where we often had dinner. It was a world of elegance and charm in that hotel. Pauline's husband, Richard, took me to Nakuru Lake, where hundreds of flamingos gathered and waded through the shallows, a blanket of pink. That was a sight I will never forget, or the smell. In the meantime, Mark was offered a job as a sales rep for Bass Charrington, a large, well-known brewery. He was asked to move to Hampshire in the south of England. The company would be paying for a rental house in Dibden Purlieu close to the New Forest, one of the most beautiful areas in England. Of course, the New Forest is not new. William the Conqueror dedicated it as a royal hunting ground in 1079. It still belongs to the Crown and to the verderers or commoners who have ancient grazing rights for their cattle. Wild ponies still wander freely through the small country villages, and they have the right of way on the roads. Vehicles must wait until the ponies have wandered lazily through the streets. Everyone knows the rules, and I've never witnessed any problems. You just can't be in a hurry. Southampton is a very large city, medieval, with the remains of a city wall and a fortress. It's also a very busy seaport, home to the QE2. Of course, it was the departure point for the Titanic. I found Southampton perfect for serious shopping because it was just a short ferry ride across the stretch of water from the village where we now lived. I realized at that time that my widow and child benefits didn't go as far when we were living in an expensive area. There was also the nagging feeling that Mark was spending a lot of time in the pubs and drinking his wages away. I knew it was time for me to go to work. I applied to a boating company at the docks in Southampton and was lucky enough to find a secretarial position at Blue Funnel Cruises. My office was above the entrance to the pier. Built in the late 1800s, it was Victorian architecture at its best and worst. Great ornate scrolls of concrete adorned the archways, upon which hung large wooden boards displaying signs and notices of various boat trips around the docks, to Portsmouth, or across the Solent Water, to the Isle of Wight. My boss, Mr. Bertram, would yell up the stairs to me in my small office at the top of the narrow stairs, "Queen's Inn!" His voice rang between the concrete walls of the ticket office below. When the QE2 docked, her great hall dwarfed our boats at the long dock. Four tender vessels escorted the Queen and then swung away in wide arcs, all piping in uniform. A unison, a sharp, shrill whoop, whoop, the Queen would answer in her low, long voice. Single horn triumphant. The boating company was owned by two partners, Horace, Bertram and Bill Holmes. Bill was a robust chap with a rubicund complexion. On his nose was a very large mole from which sprouted one single hair. This infliction of his became a fascination of mine. When I talked to him, it was hard to concentrate on anything else. It was comforting to be with Horace, who was slight of build. Horace had a wonderfully aristocratic, fine-boned face, as pale as Bill's was red. Horace had inherited Blue Funnel Cruises from his father, and Bill was a hired boatman. It was a mystery to me why they ever became partners. Their criticism of each other was sometimes cruel. Horace was ever cognizant of Bill's flurries of activities, which included overbooking passengers or sending boats out half empty. Generous to a fault, Bill would make promises that could not be kept. He and Horace would get into a shouting match. Bill would complain that Horace was a mean old bastard. Horace would call Bill a zealous old bugger who couldn't do anything he was told. Old Fred had been the owner of a small boat for 25 years. He would take visitors around the harbour. He'd stand outside the entrance to the pier every day. He cupped his hand to his mouth and shouted to anyone passing by, "Any more for the Skylark?" He would beam at everyone as the rumble of the turnstile filled the air. Every clickety-click meant another shilling in his pocket. My job at Blue Funnel Cruises was to contact bus companies and tour agencies all over Britain advertising cruise trips to the Isle of Wight in summer. The Solent Scene carried 100 passengers, and at high tide we would sail the Bewley River to take passengers to Lord Montague's Motor Museum at Butler's Hard, where Nelson ships were built during the 16th century. Life at Blue Funnel Cruises was never dull. My desk, chair, and file cabinet took up every space, every inch of space in my office. Horace or Bill would stand on the narrow staircase to talk to me, but I never felt isolated or lonely. From my small circular window, I could observe the coming and going of ships from all over the world. Large tankers docked close by, with their flags snapping in the wind. Oil tankers passed en route to the refinery at Fawley. Red Funnel ferries plied back and forth across the Solent, a stretch of 22 miles, known as the Channel, to France. This was before the Channel was built, of course. The hovercraft on its way to the Isle of Wight sounded like a large bumblebee as it slid down the ramp to the sea, and the hydrofoil spumed its way to France every day. I could see them all from my window. I would remember those days as some of the happiest in my life. Now, if you remember earlier in my story, I mentioned my desire to go to college. I found the opportunity when I learned that Blue Funnel Cruises operated only in the summer months. At last, I was able to attend the Art College in Southampton, who offered a certificate in fashion and textile design. That included pattern cutting, which posed a problem because that year England became metric. Yards became meters, a drastic change when pattern cutting is involved, since there's a 4-inch difference between a meter and a yard. A meter is almost 4 inches longer, which made math in design hard for me. Pattern cutting is all math. Although I was good at drawing and I loved to create designs that really looked good on normal girls, not just models, who were 6 feet tall and slender as a reed. I knew how to draw details for construction necessary in mass production. The order of sewing pieces that go into an elaborate evening dress is not complicated, but it has to be thought thoroughly through, very carefully. I liked the process, not realizing that in the distant future I would own my own company as a designer of silk lingerie. Many people believe that home economists study cooking only. That isn't so. I would later belong to an organization with the designation HIBS, an acronym for Home Economist in Business, HEIB. You have been listening to episode 23 of 9 o'clock Horses. This is Angela Ewing with KCIW Curry Coast Community Radio. Listen next time to episode 24, and you may hear us on podcast at kciw.org. That's kciw.org. Thank you for listening.